You probably know, or you may not know, but I worked with Iggy on his album last year, the early part of last year, and we tried writing together constantly before we went into the studio, because often I've got a habit of writing in the studio, but this time we sort of worked it out before, and it worked great with him, so I tried the same system for me. The 11th track is an Iggy track. Some bands do Stones, some bands do Chuck Berry, and I cover Iggy Pop.
While David Bowie has made several chameleonic and destructive changes in his life, one thing has remained constant: his friendship and collaboration with James Osterberg, Iggy Pop. Together they have written such Bowie hits as China Girl and half of the Tonight album, while David Bowie produced Iggy's latest album, Blah Blah Blah.
Congratulations.
That work was certified gold in Canada, the first time Iggy has received such an award anywhere in the world.
Thank you.
And we're going platinum.
Thank you very much.
Hello and welcome back to Album with me, Arslan Mohammed, and the fourth and final part of our mammoth 1980 More Show extravaganza with the complete David Bowie author and expert on all things Ziggular, Nick Pegg. We'll be back again soon with more albums, more guests and more Zoom-related recording glitches, but for now, join us as we go back in time to the late 1980s and find out how David Bowie was spending his time between glass spiders and tin machines. Hope you enjoy.
Blah Blah Blah, which by many estimations was Iggy's best album for some time, and it was his most successful album at the time, for I think full stop, wasn't it?
I think it was commercially.
Yeah. Real Wild Child, which was the first single off, it was certainly Iggy's first ever hit single, which is extraordinary when you think about it now. You think about those classic older numbers like, I don't know, Nightclubbing and Lust for Life and things. They have subsequently, some of them have become hits because they've been used in movies and things. But at the time, Real Wild Child, 86, was Iggy's first big hit. And Bowie co-produced this album for him, and as I say, it was actually their last collaboration, and this was recorded in Switzerland in April and May 86. So we're now nearly a year on from Live Aid and Absolute Beginners and all those sort of things. And it's round about the time, of course, that Absolute Beginners was actually released. Bowie, while having this number two hit, is in Montreux recording Blah Blah Blah, the Iggy Pop album, which was released later that year in October. And the interesting thing about this album is that, not unlike what had happened back in 1976, Bowie and Iggy worked on Iggy's album, The Idiot. Bowie was at the same time sort of testing the water for whether this was a nice way to work for his next project. I think most people would agree that The Idiot and Low were more successful results than Blah 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 and Never Let Me Down, but there is a kind of analogy there that, you know, apparently they it was again very 1980s. Bowie and Iggy would go skiing in the day and then they'd come back to Bowie's place in the evening and do some writing. Bowie was heavily into skiing at this point. He was, wasn't he?
And I think this was a little smash hits trope as well. They loved the story that Bowie had taught Iggy to ski. I seem to remember.
That's right. He taught Iggy Pop to ski. That's right.
I think there was a sneaky drugs reference going on, but I mean, I remember they would bring this up in every conversation. Wasn't this also featuring Steve Jones?
That's right. Steve Jones of the Pistols is on this album, as is again Kevin Armstrong, the man from Live Aid and etc. And again Erdal Kizilke, who of course was Bowie had initially first met him in Switzerland. That's where they got together at in Montreux. And so Erdal Kizilke was becoming a kind of quite regular collaborator at this point with Bowie. So he's on the album as well, along with various other people. And they're recording it at Mountain, where Bowie would then go on to record Never Let Me Down not long afterwards. So yeah, the Blah 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 sessions, as I say, April and May, it was during these sessions that one day in the studio they heard news that something terrible had happened in Ukraine, and they all kind of stopped what they were doing and started listening to the radio, and all these sort of apocalyptic tales of nuclear clouds billowing across the landscape. And that moment of Chernobyl possibly slightly finds its way into a couple of songs on Blah Blah Blah, though that may just be conjecture. I'm not quite sure whether the songs were already written, but there are a couple of numbers that feel... Yeah, shades, but certainly for Bowie... Yeah, exactly, yeah. But certainly for Bowie, Chernobyl was became a thing. He kind of wrote he wrote about it very well. He references it by name directly in Shining Star, not one of the best songs on Never Let Me Down. But there's also a definite post Chernobyl, post space shuttle exploding, which happened around about this time as well, feel on Time Will Crawl, which of course by most estimations is one of the better songs on Never Let Me Down. So that's interesting. It's a funny little moment in time, isn't it? And this was this horrible moment in the middle of the 80s when just horrible things seemed to be happening the time. We'd had Ethiopia, we'd had the terrible Union Carbide disaster at Bhopal, also at the end of 84. There was the space shuttle blowing up at the beginning of 86. Then there was Chernobyl in April 86. And it was lurking in the background of all this, of course, was just the what felt at the time like the constant threat of nuclear conflict as well, you know, which we tend to forget as well. So it was not a particularly jolly time. And I think, however superficially slick and polished and a bit 80s these albums sound, blah blah blah, and Never Let Me Down, I mean, I think there is that sense of anxiety in them, that sense of kind
absolutely.
Of
absolutely yes
mid 80s angst, and I think, and blah 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 is a fine album. I think it's not an album I regularly revisit, I have to say. It's not, it doesn't for me have quite the same punch as those ones that Bowie did with Iggy in the 70s, you know, The Idiot and Lust for Life. But it's, you know, it's a fine upstanding album. It like Never Let Me Down, it sounds very very 80s. It sounds quite dated, I think.
Like you say, with that band that played on Never Let Me Down and coming from the same sort of mentality. Yeah, there's quite a nice echo with the whole late 70s relationship with Bowie and Iggy, and kind of bleeding over that there was between Heroes, Low, The Idiot, Lust for Life. You know, there's a lot of crossover with those albums. Likewise here. And I believe after this was recorded, there was some resentment by Iggy that he didn't want to record another album with Bowie because he didn't, you know, he felt that it was pretty much a Bowie album that he'd sung on. Certainly at some points he expressed some resentment about this, and they didn't work again.
It would be over egging it to suggest that they had some sort of falling out. I don't think that's true at all. And Iggy has obviously, since Bowie's death, and has spoken so fondly about him and said what, you know, he was the light of his life and his best friend and everything. But when you're an intelligent person and a creative artist, as Iggy is, you know, fiercely intelligent person and a brilliant writer, it must be a little bit irritating to... For your best known work to sort of exist in the shadow of someone else who, you know, and I think, you know, it's exactly the same thing as Mott the Hoople with all the young dudes. They loved it and they knew it was their salvation, but then they had to sort of live in the shadow of it for that, and that's why they didn't immediately after that, you know, Ian Hunter turned down the offer of another Bowie song because he had to prove to himself and to everyone else that they weren't just some sort of David Bowie pet project.
Absolutely.
That they were and I guess there's a sense of that with Iggy, that he you know, I'm sure he loved working with Bowie, and I think he liked the work that they produced as well, but he didn't want to just be under Bowie's sort of, you know,
sure, he didn't cape. Want to be seen as Bowie's perpetual pet project, you know, he wants to get out and author his own work and create his own work without the burden that came with being Bowie's friend and Bowie's collaborator.
Yes.
And I think certainly a lot of people in the media would have lazily rather written that collaboration off as being very one-sided. You know, Bowie was the genius and the brains and the talent, and Iggy was this kind of washed-up 70s punk who just got lucky. You know, certainly there was a lot of people who perceived like that. But he did do this album. It was a hit. It was, a you know, Iggy's big hit album. And looking back at it now, the sound is, you know, I think of John Hughes films, a Californian high school movie drama is going on. And the bad boy shows up, you know, on a motorbike and they're playing Real Wild
Isolation
Child.
Or Real Wild Child. Absolutely. And it's got those very echoey drums and all those sort of mid-80s cliches, hasn't it? But yeah, I mean, I think they're good songs, and I think it's you know, it's a nice album to pop on every now and then. And whatever else it did, it was Bowie, you know, they, as with all of Bowie's collaborators, each brought something that the other needed, didn't they, really? I mean, you know, but Iggy gave Bowie a kind of edginess and a street creddiness that Bowie craved, you know, that was a lot of Iggy's input, especially right in the early days, you know, that's what Bowie kind of got from Iggy, that's what he identified in him and sort of synthesized for himself. On the other side of it, Bowie gave Iggy a kind of commercial sheen. I mean, you know, Blah 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 is the album that finally allowed Iggy Pop to appear on Top of the Pops, you know, and do Real Wild Child and actually get seen by normal people rather than music obsessives.
It was a very mutually enriching relationship, and then certainly it wasn't as imbalanced as some people might believe. You're absolutely right. There was a very substantial give and take on both sides. I mean, Bowie would have invested so much time and energy and passion into his friendship and his collaborations had he not felt so much in Iggy's debt for that inspiration, for the work Iggy had done. So I think this final substantial did they collaborate at all on any
after that
or anything after this?
Don't think so. No, I don't think so.
This
I think this is the very last time they worked together. Which is interesting, isn't it? Because it is quite a long time ago now.
Well, at the same time as Blah Blah Blah, and in the shadow of Chernobyl, like you mentioned, Bowie recorded the title track for When the Wind Blows.
That's right. So making it in 1986, given the release date, it's a kind of hat trick of amazing film themes. We've already had Absolute Beginners, we've already had Underground, both came out in 86, and now we have When the Wind Blows, which, was recorded around about the same time as the Blah 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 sessions. It was released in November 86. So it was a lot of Bowie happening towards the end of 86. You know, it was stuff that had happened because Labyrinth, the film, was... And now we have When the Wind Blows,
Another Raymond Briggs movie.
Another Raymond Briggs movie, of course, It was Bowie's second sort of collaboration, as it were, with Raymond Briggs, because he had done the film that sweet, beautiful little introduction to the Snowman a few years earlier. And of course, not just his second collaboration with Raymond Briggs, but with Jimmy Murakami, who was the director of both of those things. He directed the Snowman and he directed When the Wind Blows. He was an American animator. He died a few years ago now. He lived to a good old age. He was already, you know, quite an elder statesman when he did When the Wind Blows. Yeah, he'd previously done the Snowman. He also directed that film Battle Beyond the Stars. Do you remember that? Produced by Roger Corman. It's not bad. It's one of those sort of Star Wars type cash-in type films, but it's great. It's very he animated some of the BBC's Chronicles of Narnia a bit later in the 80s as well. One of the last things he did, obligatory Kate Bush mention. You know, if Kate Bush can be mentioned, I always will. He directed the video for Kate Bush's comeback single King of the Mountain in 2005, the single that was off from the Aerial album after her many, many years of silence. That was also directed by Jimmy Murakami, who did this this deeply distressing adult, I suppose adult, picture book by Raymond Briggs. I mean, children could read it if they wanted to, but here we are. You see, it was the mid-1980s, and as we said a moment ago, you know, the threat of nuclear Armageddon was all the rage, if that's the right way to put it.
Part of the fabric of everyday culture, wasn't
it? Really was. I mean, I was a teenager at the time, and I can genuinely remember, you know, thinking it wasn't worth doing my homework because the missiles were going to start flying any minute. I mean, but it was all over the place. You know, we'd already had, you know, things like Edge of Darkness and Threads, you know, that terrifying film by Barry Hines about a nuclear strike on Sheffield. And we'd had the film War Games and, you know, it was all in the air everywhere. And pop music was riddled with it. You know, Two Tribes, Paul McCartney had done Pipes of Peace a couple of years before, 99 Red Balloons by Nena, Hammer to Fall, Culture Club's hugely evocative The War Song. Nick Kershaw, I Won't Let the Sun Go Down on Me, which is a bouncy pop song about nuclear Armageddon. And there were dozens and dozens and dozens of these songs coming out. Duran Duran, of course. Let's not forget, Don't Say You're Easy on Me. You're about as easy as a nuclear war.
Exactly.
One of the great lyrics of all time.
Greatest couplets of all time.
Absolutely. Oh, I could do an obligatory Kate Bush, of course. Breathing by Kate Bush was also, but that was earlier. That was 1980, wasn't it? But yeah. So anyway, this was in the air the entire time. It was a part of, as you say, the fabric of what we were living through at the time. So When the Wind Blows lands smack in the middle of this, and this is Bowie's sort of contribution to the mid-1980s nuclear paranoia pop song genre, and it's a goodie. I think it's fantastic. It's again co-written with Erdal Kızılkay, who plays a fantastic bass on it. That wonderful kind of tricksy time signature, that ding ding diddly diddly do 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 boom boom. It's fabulous. Bowie sings. He's giving one of his really full-throated sort of you know, gazing heroically into the horizon, sort of vocals
one of the
on
big
it,
big epic vocals.
Yeah, and I mean, it's terrific. This is for me in Bowie's underrated 80s. When the Wind Blows is up there with Absolute Beginners and with Cat People, and you know, these I love it, I think it's terrific. Maybe the, you know, the production doesn't sound quite as full throttle as some of the others, maybe, you know, but it's I love it. It's wonderful.
Big praise putting it up there with Absolute Beginners.
Well, look, nothing's up there with Absolute Beginners. Not that I do favourites, as you know. But it's certainly knocking at the door.
You came very close, didn't I?
I've just realised. Oh no. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's knocking at the door of some of those other songs. It really is.
It doesn't have much, it's a bit like, well, actually, no, it's not a bit like This Is Not America. It doesn't have much of an afterlife. I can't remember him ever playing this live.
No, he never did it. Well, again, as you say, yes, it was one of those songs, and we've mentioned a few of these over the course of this 80s discussion. It's another one of those songs that did totally fall off the radar. It wasn't a huge hit. It only got to number 44, so that's not big. I think I'm right in saying that the first time it appeared on a compilation was not until into the 2000s. I think, when it did eventually turn up on one of those, one of the many best ofs. But yeah, he never performed it live. There was a video, which of course was directed by Murakami, mostly consisting just of sort of clips from the film. But Bowie does appear in the film as well, in the video as well, as a sort of silhouette. Kind of
silhouettes and sort of solarized little clips and stuff. I remember watching it. It's to me, it's not particularly memorable, which is why I was a bit surprised at your lusty praise for it.
I love it. I'm not convincing you, am I? I think it's a real goodie. We've said this several times already in this chat, but it's interesting that a project that's actually someone else's project that Bowie is invited into results in something so strong. It may be damning it with faint praise, but I think it's certainly on a par with the best of Never Let Me Down, for example. But you see, to me, that is praise, because I think Time Will Crawl and Glass Spider are terrific songs. I think When the Wind Blows is a good little number.
Okay, you always put your arguments for everything so eloquently and with such heartfelt passion, and I think that's exactly what's needed, you know.
But on this occasion,
come on. These are all subjective things. I mean, I'm not going to agree with you on everything, but
of course.
You always articulate it so well, just exactly why you love something, and that's always just a real pleasure to listen to.
Even if it's a load of old codswallop. Yeah. Okay.
Let's move on from When the Wind Blows.
Hard on the heels of When the Wind Blows, in terms of Bowie's kind of timeline, we then get to the Never Let Me Down album, and that's followed, of course, by the Glass Spider tour. So that's the end of 86 and pretty much all of 1987 consumed by this massive juggernaut of a thing. But there's one little project that he did in the spring of 87, which is maybe worthy of just pausing to have a little chat about, which is the Pepsi commercial that he did with Tina Turner. Now, Tina Turner is someone who we haven't really talked about, who pops up through Bowie's 80s all the way through, which is an interesting thing. And actually, going back to right near the beginning of this discussion, on our first session, you asked me if Cat People had ever been covered by anyone. And at the time, I completely dried and I said, probably. But the answer is, of course, yes, of course people have covered Cat People. There are several cover versions. Charlene Spiteri did quite a nice version, actually. But one of the first people to cover Cat People was Tina Turner.
Red like jungle running track.
She did it live on a 1984 edition of The Tube on Channel 4, which is quite an unusual thing to do, isn't it? But interestingly, of course, Bowie had already done his re-recording and the Serious Moonlight Tour version of Cat People at that point. But in Tina Turner's version on The Tube, she sort of stuck to the sort of Giorgio Moroder type arrangement, which is interesting. Yeah, so that's a nice... I don't know if that's on YouTube. You can go and find it. It's a nice performance. But the interesting thing about Bowie's sort of dynamic with Tina Turner through the 80s is, you know, and Tina Turner has spoken about this very beautifully, is that she credits David Bowie with resurrecting her career at the beginning of the 1980s. Her career had gone somewhat into the doldrums, you know, before her big comeback. And it was round about the time, or exactly at the time, that Bowie was being wooed by new record companies. You know, he was signing to EMI with Let's Dance, sort of end of 82, beginning of 83, round about then. And the story, as Tina Turner tells it, is that all these hotshot executives were sort of dancing around David Bowie saying, ooh, you know, do you want to sign here? Bowie said, yeah, great. And by the way, why don't you all come with me to this concert tonight? I'm going to see one of my favourite singers. And because they all wanted to, you know, be on David Bowie's right side, they all went along with him to the concert. And it was Tina Turner, who at the time, you know, according to her, you know, couldn't get arrested. And she gave a fantastic show. And the rest is history. You know, Private Dancer, Simply the Best, she's off. And she
That's such
was
a lovely story.
Yeah. And she so totally credits Bowie with that happening, because these guys just, you know, snapped her up on the spot. And so during the 1980s, obviously Bowie has her as a guest on Tonight, on the song Tonight, on the album.
Yes, of course.
And then
yes.
In that busy year of 1985, a little thing that we didn't mention is that in March of 85, so round about the time that he's working on Absolute Beginners and so on, Bowie popped up for two nights as a special guest in the encores of Tina Turner's live shows at Birmingham NEC, and the video exists of that, of course, great, because it was a surprise guest, so they didn't know that he was coming on. And when he appears at the back, she sings the first verse of Tonight, and then Bowie just appears just in time to start singing everything, the second verse.
Oh, so
and
she didn't know that he was coming
on. Oh, no, she knew, but the crowd didn't. She knew. Of course she knew. No, that would be weird.
Standing there with him is another whole different power, because his power is different. Mick's power is physical and visual. David's is still and big. Do you understand? I can explain. I think when I said to him, I want you to come on the end of my show at in London, and I said, this is what I'd like for you to do. It's a surprise. I said, I'd like for you to come up the stairs from the back. I said, and just standing there being golden. That was how I saw him. And when he did just that, how I envisioned, the place went crazy. It sounded like an earthquake, just like today, because it's that still power that he has.
And he comes down and they finish the song together, and then they do a bit of a sort of, Bowie says it's a huge honour to share the stage with Tina. She's one of my favourite artists. And the crowd, of course, composed, of course, of Tina Turner fans, goes wild at that praise. And then she praises him. And then they go into a medley of Chris Montez's Let's Dance, segueing into David Bowie's Let's Dance. And it's cheesy as heck. But it's lovely. So anyway, Bowie and Tina, they kind of had a bit of a mutual appreciation society thing going on in the 80s. There's an outtake from Never Let Me Down called Girls, which was a B-side. It was a B-side of Time Will Crawl. Tina Turner recorded her own version of that as well. Bowie actually kind of wrote it for her.
She does pick esoteric choices, doesn't she?
She certainly does, yeah. So, on her 1984 album, she actually covered Bowie's song 1984 as well.
Of course she does. Yes.
Yeah.
I love that.
It's good, isn't it? So all of this amazing Bowie and Turner business culminates in this glorious moment of silliness, which was filmed in May 1987, just as the Glass Spider tour was being rehearsed. It was filmed in Amsterdam, which is where Bowie was about to open the tour. And the point of doing it, as Bowie explained at the time in an interview, I think possibly in that Smash Hits interview that I mentioned earlier, was purely to raise funds for the Glass Spider tour, because it was a massive, massive undertaking. And by doing that Pepsi commercial, he could pay for not one but two sets, basically, which made all the difference, because it meant that the sets could leapfrog, you know. So while they're performing in London, crew is already fitting up in Paris for the day after tomorrow or whatever. And it
I
just had to
two
be like
glass
that.
Spiders,
yeah,
not just
absolutely.
One.
So this whole story about the one Glass Spider being burnt in a field at the end or whatever is clearly not true, because they had more than one of them. Anyway, so that was
why... both of them in a field.
Yeah, and burned both of them. So
it is so hokey and just silly, isn't it? You know, Bowie plays this nutty professor in a lab, slicked back hair
and sort of geeky glasses and things. So he looks like a geek. Yeah, he's a geek. He's in his white coat and everything. And he's obviously sort of on a mission to make the perfect woman or something. So he pops into his science fiction machine a pair of leather boots and a couple of other bits and bobs, and then pulls the lever and lightning crackles. And it's kind of Frankenstein, but it's also, what's that film from a couple of years before? Weird Science. It's kind of that.
Weird Science thing.
Yeah, where there's two boys create a sexy woman. Yeah. And so anyway, so the whole thing blows up, and oh, that's right. No, of course, what happens is he accidentally spills his bottle of Pepsi. Onto the machine, and that's the magic ingredient, of course, Pepsi, and everything blows up, and the door of the chamber bursts open, and out comes Tina Turner. He's created Tina Turner, and then they dance off down the road, singing "Modern Love," of course,
a version of "Modern Love," where
with
the choice
lyrics
is mine.
Suitably retooled to go with the Pepsi slogan at the time.
Mind.
And the whole thing is about 20 seconds long, and it is an absolute hoot. So that's the Pepsi ad, and then, of course, having bankrolled the Glass Spider Tour, off he goes on the Glass Spider Tour, and that takes up pretty much the rest of 87. And right at the end of 87, he goes off to Morocco to shoot his part in The Last Temptation of Christ, playing Pontius Pilate, one of his really excellent acting performances. I think it's a small scene, but he, again, so much dedication, so much work. It's a lovely thing at the David Bowie Is V&A exhibition. There was a little room devoted to his acting work and had little bits of costumes and memorabilia. And one of the most interesting things there was Bowie's little set of self-made notes about the character of Pontius Pilate. You know, he'd studiously written down some ideas, you know, all his ideas about who he was and what he was, you know, where he was at in his head and what sort of an education he had. You know, it was fascinating to just see that little insight into Bowie as an actor. He wasn't just someone who turned up and said, right, where do I stand? He had really thought about it, you know. And it shows. It's a lovely performance.
It's also said that you do miracles. Is this good magic or bad magic? Could we have some kind of demonstration? I mean, can you do a trick for me now, say?
No, I'm not a trained animal. I'm not a magician.
Well, that's disappointing.
So anyway, that's the end of 87. And then we come to 1988, which was David Bowie's quietest year yet. It was the quietest year of his career. The first year for 20 years that not a single new Bowie record was released. So the first year since 1968 that he didn't release so much as a single. But what he did do, and it was absolutely key for everything that was to come afterwards, was that he got together with some musicians, something old, something new. He got together with Erdal Kazilke again, and a hotshot young guitarist by the name of Reeves Gabrels, whose wife
Gabrels,
had
you
worked...
Whatever happened to him?
Whatever happened to him, yeah. Reeves Gabrels, his wife had been working as a PA on the Glass Spider Tour, and at some stage towards the end of the tour, so Reeves had sort of socialised a bit and everything. He slipped David a cassette and apparently, according to Bowie, he didn't even know that Reeves particularly played guitar. Yeah. But Bowie had a little listen to it and thought, ooh, this boy's good. And anyway, in 1988, Bowie was asked to make a contribution to a show called Intruders at the Palace, which was a benefit concert for the ICA, the Institute of Contemporary Arts. And the show was actually at the Dominion Theatre at the bottom of Tottenham Court Road in London. And so what Bowie comes up with is a wizard wheeze. He's, at this point, he's come off the Glass Spider Tour for months and months and months. The Glass Spider Tour had not had the best reviews, and in any case, Bowie, probably the last thing he wanted to do was something big and elaborate like that. He wanted to do something small and stylish and, you know, different, obviously. And so, what he decides to do is, it's actually a bit Glass Spider-y, but in a much sort of more stripped-down way, because he got in touch with this wonderful French-Canadian dance troupe called La 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 Human Steps, run by a guy called Edouard Locke and one of his dancers, Louise Le Cavalier. and with them devised an extraordinary piece of avant-garde dance theatre to accompany a new re-recording of his 1979 song Look Back in Anger, from Lodger, of course. So they go into the studio and they record a new version. Erdal Kazilke on drums and bass, Reeves Gabrels on lead guitar, and David Bowie on vocals. And they record this rather fabulous new version. But then they performed it live at the Dominion for this production, and it's the most extraordinary spectacle. And again, I'm sure people have seen it, but if you haven't, I think you can find it on YouTube. And it was, by common consent, the beginning of David Bowie's kind of post-Glass Spider renaissance. Suddenly, you know, gone is the gold lame suit and the funny mercury boots with wings on them and abseiling out of things and explosions going off. But it's no less theatrical for that. He's there in this incredibly cool sort of charcoal suit doing this extraordinary sort of voguing, yes. And at the same time, Louise Le Cavalier is doing these amazing sort of body thrashing, sort of jumping over Bowie's back, yeah. and thrashing around, and all the while the band, this tiny band, it's sort of two men, a drum machine and a trumpet sort of thing, are doing this fabulous version of Look Back in Anger. Reeves Gabrels, you know, just giving it exactly what it needs, this jangly, very sort of avant-garde guitar, almost a kind of a Adrian Belew feel to it, but he's very much his own guitarist, Reeves, doing his own thing with it. And Bowie just looking so cool and so in command of this little performance, and it kind of blew everyone away. First time, I think, for quite some time, that the music press just walked away from that and gave him an absolute A star across the board. Oh my God, this is what we've been waiting for, David. And of course, this led on to everything that came afterwards. Bowie found that he loved working with Reeves. He said, "Do you want to do some more?" Reeves said yes, and the rest is Tin Machine, you know. If the Sales Brothers had not entered the picture, Tin Machine might have been a much more sort of strange, edgy, avant-garde, outside-y type thing than it became. But that's okay. That's everything evolves. Yeah, everything evolves.
If that hadn't happened, if the Sales Brothers hadn't entered stage left, and Reeves and Bowie had their heads and they'd put together an album to be the follow-up to Never Let Me Down, God knows in what direction the 90s would have gone in. But
yeah, well,
this
absolutely,
is such
absolutely.
A pivotal moment. Yeah. I mean, this one-off performance, you know, I mean, La La La, Human Steps, they were known for their dramatic, incredibly mind-blowing dance moves. I think that kind of barreling, twisting through the air was a bit of a trademark of theirs. And like you say, that clip of Bowie doing that is just astonishing. And imagine if you'd been a Bowie fan, you'd been a bit disheartened by the Glass Spider tour and the bombast and the, you know, the massive theatricality of this. To see something as sort of pared down and just such physicality, just such immediacy in that performance would have been incredibly exciting. And of course, like you're saying, it led on to Tin Machine, which is another story.
Which is another story for another time. But it's interesting that even there, you know, yes, it was in many ways, it was a kind of radical break from what he'd been up to lately. But in other ways, there's always that continuity with Bowie. And, you know, it did, let's not forget that the Glass Spider Tour did have avant-garde American dancers,
course,
doing
yeah.
weird things. And it's not a million miles away from that. It's just that it is, it's much more disciplined, minimalist, absolutely. And the costuming, it's absolutely sort of black and white, monochrome. They're all just wearing black or grey, rather than this explosion of colour and things. And it's a great version of the song and a great bookend, as you say, because, yeah, we're right back at the beginning of all this, we talked about how Bowie's sort of entry into the 1980s was that extraordinary avant-garde appearance on Saturday Night Live. And it's rather neat, isn't it, that his sort of, at least as a solo artist, his kind of bookend end of the 1980s before relaunching the Tin Machine is this extraordinary Intruders at the Palace performance of Look Back in Anger, another song from Lodger, like, you know, Boys Keep Swinging Back Then and Look Back in Anger. There's a wonderful symmetry to it, you know?
And that's where we leave Bowie revitalised, reinvigorated, a new collaborator, a new best buddy by his side, and onwards onto Tin Machine, and then onto Sound and Vision. And then immediately, the month after the Sound and Vision tour concludes in September 1990, a friend sets him up on a blind date.
Yeah.
And the rest is
and the
history.
Rest is history,
but
yeah.
We'll come to that next time. But yeah, but I think for now, we leave David Bowie there, and we leave you there, dear listeners, because that is David Bowie in the 1980s, the episode that Nick and I have referred to for a long time as the 1980 More Show. We've talked about this for ages and ages about doing this, and who'd have thought?
What a journey!
So much to
who'd
say.
Have thought there was so much in it?
who'd have thought there was so much in it? But honestly, Nick, this has been an absolute tour de force. Thank you so much. It's been
a huge pleasure. It's lovely to talk about these things. I mean, I'll enjoy talking about any aspect of David Bowie until the cows come home. But it's especially lovely to talk about the stuff that doesn't get talked about as much. So it's been an absolute joy. Thank you very much.
And that was the fourth and final part of my colossal chat with Nick Pegg about Bowie's work in the 1980s. And my thanks to Nick for being such a genial and convivial guest. So I hope you enjoyed this episode and, in fact, the whole 1980 More series. So do share and spread the word if so. And meanwhile, I'll be releasing some new episodes soon. So keep an ear out and do drop me a line if you've got any questions or comments about this or any other episode of Album to Album. But in the meantime, thanks for listening and see you again soon. Bye for now.